On Perspective this week, we take a nostalgic look at one presenter's half century of broadcasting. He also discusses with me how things need to change to prepare for the next 50 years. So, the mystery broadcaster who has managed 50 whole years in broadcasting in the Isle of Man, we can now reveal is...
Paul Moulton. It's a love line on 219. That was an amazing time. But actually, I looked at it. This only came out when I was working out years. And I went, oh my goodness, I was 16 and I got a holiday job here sort of thing. But it was really 14 when I did my first interaction because I was at school and I did my O-level project on Manx Radio. And I remember walking up the hill and standing outside the door in the rain for at least half an hour because I was too early. And in those days, Manx Radio was only on the top floor. It's all the bomb areas was deserted. But
and for people who don't know Manx Radio, there's a kind of the basement area in which at the moment there's a kitchen and a kind of an engine room which has lots of gubbins in it that presumably allows this to be broadcast. There's the sales team. Accounts that then the what might be described as the ground floor, but it's hard to describe anything as ground in this building. The middle floor anyway is kind of the newsroom.
I think it'd been empty since Valkyrie moved.
But basically, that was just sitting empty.
There's 15 people, I think, all on one floor, everything.
And then all the studios, of course, on the top floor. So
Well, it was only the top floor. That was it. Everyone was on the top floor. Peter Neal's offices was basically where we're sitting now, I think. So that was my first interaction. And by the way, if anyone's got the book that Peter Neal had, he had all these cuttings of the history from before it started, and I used that for my O-level project. And I've never seen it since, and since his departure, unfortunately. I don't know where it is, and if anyone's got it or knows about it, it's a great history of the radio station. Really, really good.
No, it would be great to have as a record, really, wouldn't it, to know all
there's a lot of hoo-ha before Manx Radio ever got on the air.
And actually, in the trailer for this program, I've talked about government's involvement, and it's one of the. I mean, I remember we had you interviewed me about 10 years ago when I was still a minister in the government.
Oh, you were being interviewed all the time. You were great, Phil. And you were always available. Thank you so much.
Which is probably why I'm now an interviewer rather than interviewee. But that's another matter. We were discussing how the future of the media should look, anyway, in the trailer to this program, we were talking about the influence of government, and government played a fairly fundamental role in starting broadcasting on the Isle of Man, really, didn't they?
Yeah, and the UK government were controlling the frequencies, and they what was it? It was FM 91.2, I think, initially. No one had FM radio in those days. It was really sort of, we don't want you to do it, but you know, then they got 188 meters and 232, but 232 was only for daytime medium wave usage, and 188 was so far down the bottom of the dial you couldn't get almost hear it. It was almost like shortwave. But that was my first broadcasting, actually, thinking about it. I sat in probably roughly where we are now, and with a very high pitched voice in those days, I would run outside, click a button, and the medium waves 188 would just separate from 232 and the rest of the output. And I'd come in here and go, and now it's time for Let the Bible Speak. All those religious programs, do you remember those? Because that was a money spinner. Well, I don't mean a money spinner, but Manx Radio needed every penny they could get. So we dumped these religious programs on 188 all through the day in those days. And at night time, I don't know if you remember, Manx Radio shut down about, I don't know, 6 or 7 at the latest, and then be all the Power Hour, Gospel, Touch the Screen.
Frank and Ernest, I remember all them all.
That was the Manx Radio output, but because nowhere in the UK, or British Isles is probably a better way of putting it, could you have religious broadcasting, paid for religious broadcasting, American religious broadcasting, which was pretty crazy stuff. I don't know if it ever made any money for them, but hey.
Did the young 16-year-old Paul Moulton ever think that this was going to be a long-term prospect, or was this just a means to an end?
I moved over when I was 13, moved over my parents to live here, and I turned the radio one day and I heard Manx Radio. And you know, like when you just have that thing go, oh my gosh, that's it, I want to do that. I mean, I made sure that I was going to work here, because when I moved in here at 16, I came in just to help out, you know, make teas and coffees, made myself so useful that eventually they offered me this Saturday job here. And it was on a sports program and I had to look after things. But then, weirdly, there was quite a lot of unionisation. Can you believe that in those days? Yeah. Wally McAvoy was the union rep. And when he found out that this young chap was going to be involved in radio, he wanted to know why, and all those sort of things. So in the end, there were three people involved in a 10-minute sports programme, plus the presenter, four people, because I wasn't deemed to be okay. I had to have other people involved who were on the payroll. So, yeah, that was a great thing, because I was down at King Bill's, but they let me out on Saturdays to come up here.
Hmm.
And John Moss used to run me back to school.
Gosh.
Isn't that crazy, isn't it?
That's nice.
I mean, how it was. But, it was times I would never, ever miss. I mean, radio was so, so real in those days. I mean, it makes me sound so old, but none of this just hit a button on a computer. Having your vinyl, your carts, phone access. No other radio station could you ring the studio and just get the presenter. We were always busy taking calls on 4299, Manx Radio's dedication line. I'd made a jingle for that. I just put it in. I mean, this is when I started working full time. And I didn't tell Alan Jackson, who was the program controller. See, I just did things.
It's often best to do the thing and then ask afterwards.
He wasn't impressed.
Oh, gosh.
Well, Alan Jackson ran a tight ship. Now, there you go. Alan Jackson. There was a man who was of this moment. He was huge. Manx Radio and him. And he would do the original Man in Line, but he'd just have the phone on a cradle by the microphone. And he would be listening to them. He could bring them up, but they couldn't hear him or something. It was really early days of phone-in programs, but he was a tour de force. He knew how to make radio work, and he kept us going in quite a good direction. Then, of course, he left to go to Radio Merseyside, but then came back to work Monday to Friday here, then weekends at Radio Merseyside. And I got brought in to be his sort of, not a psychic, I had to read weather and traffic and things, because that was when Manx Radio went into North Wales and North England. Do you remember all that stuff? So I'm probably jumping way ahead here, but that was a very strange time. The TT, one of the years, was on FM. Now, you know how it's an AM thing, but that caused major eruptions because they couldn't interrupt this service they thought they were providing to North Wales. And all the adverts, there were so many adverts for Welsh companies and places in Blackpool. It never was going to really work, but we had a great time because I went and over to do discos in Blackpool, and we would record them and then put them out. And then it came quite clear we were very big in North Wales, and I was, sounds very grand now, the plane would pick me up.
Big in North Wales, there's a claim to fame.
In Anglesey, particularly in Llandudno. But yeah, they would fly me over, go to my hotel, come down at whatever time, hand out records. People screamed at me. Then I went back to my room. And that's when I realised I'm not into this thing like that. People were screaming at me. They didn't know who I was, what was going on. But it was a crazy time because North Wales, and especially Anglesey, had no local radio. So they did look upon us as a sort of thing to listen to. Great times, amazing times.
We'll maybe move on at some point to discussing this, but I guess the innovative and groundbreaking stuff that was going on in the early years is akin to what's now happening in terms of social media and the whole way in which that has exploded as a platform.
Well, I mean, there were so many things going on. There were so many interviews, and we got out a lot. I mean, my first sort of involvement was with Pat Corey, the late Pat Corey. She had a program called Roundabout between 4 and 7. So me and the producer, Charlie Webster, would get into the Manx Radio Mini, the one which had a little broadcasting pole on the top, and we would go out and about all day, and Pat did the interviews. Charlie held the microphone. I don't know what I did, but we'd get...
Drove the car, maybe.
I wish. But it was like, it was very much getting out into the community. And then these interviews would go out between 4 and 7. And that was the sort of manager. I think Mike Reynolds was probably the only person that had a music show, Reynolds in the on the radio thing in the afternoons. But Susie Richardson was on Swap Shop. And Ralph Shimon was also around. He did Night Fever originally and afternoons at some point. And Alan Jackson was on The Breakfast. Mm. Kind of crazy. Then
Alan Jackson's Jelly Buddies. I remember the Jelly Buddies, yes.
Do you remember the big April Fools he did with his helicopter?
Go ahead.
It's been talked about for many years. So he pretended he was in a helicopter. He did all the sound effects and he made all the sound. And people were ringing in saying they'd seen him just fly overhead and everything. He was in Douglas Head all the time. It was great.
But, dear.
Yeah, that's when I think that's really when I first got my first tryout was Ralph was off on Night Fever just started, so with the broadcasting hours now up till 10 before The Religion kicked in. Or, I know, tell you what, The Religion went out on AM and we went out on FM or something like that. Anyway, Ralph, his tip to me, he's also the late Ralph now as well. He said, this is my, I'm a kid, right? And his tip to me was, don't you dare be too good. Just the confidence builder you need.
Well, yes, yeah, yes, I can see. It's probably good advice to someone starting off in a competitive world. Just be careful.
It was. I mean, you know, it was a, can you imagine the disco era? I mean, that I'm talking about now, 76 onwards, really. We lived through some crazy great times. And the Isle of Man, Manx Radio, was on the Music Week chart. The Music Week is the Bible for finding out what's being played. So there's these big long lists with a dot by all these new records or whatever. And out of 19 UK radio stations, and we made the 20th. So because we were on that list, the radio stations could not be more generous with product. I mean, we got tons of records, 12 inches, you name it.
Mm.
Great times. Still got most of them as well. But, we take over a little bit of that Night Fever. Then, of course, Stu Lowe came along. He did it, and I just did the Fridays. That was probably the biggest moment for people who still remember It's the Love Line on 219, which was Trudy Williamson, or Trudy Wooden at those days. She worked downstairs in sales.
Right.
That was her voice.
Gosh.
Trudy, just speed it up slightly. She still gets that referred to all the time.
And I suppose with records, we should probably
explain
to people under the age of 50
you're
what a record
kidding.
Is.
It's
isn't it shocking? Well, I suppose it is.
It
yeah,
is.
It's more of
a bit of plastic, a bit of a
trendy thing, isn't it? But but yeah, everything was records. And how did you manage in the studio
you
to
never
do
stopped,
that?
Stopped, honestly. Mm. I mean, first of all, the record library, Mike Purcell, who's back here working these days. Mike Purcell was a librarian, but it was always being plundered for people's personal use. I mean, it wasn't good. So if I had to do an extra Night Fever or something, I had to go home, pick up my own records and bring them back. And Stulio did the same. We didn't rely on the records here, really. But it was, so you're on there, you're flicking through, trying to find your next record. The phones are going. You then also get the adverts queued up in the cart machines. I mean, I've got some great video, actually, filmed in 83, I think it was, or something like that, just doing a Night Fever and showing how it all worked. Because the Love Line was crazy. People, all four lines in the studio, 24144 in those days, it was just solid.
Hmm.
Interaction like that, you'd be pretty rare these days to get that sort of...
Well, of course, people of a certain age now, certain young age. People, don't speak anymore, do they? Everything is done by text, and they get really quite nervous at the thought of having to ring someone up.
Well, I still do a radio show for Duane. It's called The Sound. It's just online. It's only I've been doing it forever, but it's just done on the computer like most people now do, and it takes me 15 minutes to do 3 hours, and that's the difference. And it's not the same.
Yeah,
not the same. I mean, with our outside broadcasts, I learned early on that if I got the microphone and it was plugged in, I was really very lucky because you just had to live off a wing of the prayer. And you had no talk back to the studio. You just had to make a clicking sound or count down and you get on air. But you can't beat it, honestly. I mean, I had the amazing task of going... I'd left Manx Radio full time, but I got the task of going around the world for the boat race in 1999, 2000. So I had this gig to broadcast from literally around the world. And it was just awesome because I just had a little it was before the days of the little compact things. It was a Sony thing, had a little chip in it, and I could get 12 records on it, and I could play the whole show in, because it was only on medium wave back here, on this little thing, and just talk, and only went back for adverts and the news and that sort of thing. But that's what I love doing. It's great. And you know, I think outside broadcast is something that really is important to a radio station, I think, getting in and mingling. I mean, I spent a lot of Saturdays opening fairs, like not just me, I mean, you know, Susie and the rest. We'd always be invited somewhere because we were very much part of the community.
Anyone listening fancies a fair opening, calls your man.
No, because one of them, they had a welly wanging competition, and it hit me in the face, and it floored me. And I was, honestly, it sounds so grand, but I had a friend of mine, she actually looked after these things in my diary, because it was like all the time, there was things going on. And Manx Radio, it's hard to explain, was just very much in the community. And I think it did its job really well. And we were under a lot of pressure. I mean, we were subsidised, I think, for $250,000 from the government. But they really didn't want to do it. And we got a lot of stick for why we, you know, what's that money doing, that sort of thing. But, you know, just before I started, they were still doing flower arranging on the radio.
And what? You must explain how you can possibly do flower arranging on the radio.
Exactly. You need to find one of those old programme schedules and just see what was in there, because... Yeah, and that was always the most crazy one. How do you do flower arranging on the radio?
Yeah, that's a challenge, actually. That sounds like the sort of thing we might do on Gullet Gag, and I'm going to challenge one of my guests, and we'll do some flower arranging. We had a potato cake tasting session.
Ooh, nice.
on last week's show. So we're
you got cameras right involved as well.
Yeah,
so people can see it. It's not the same, is it?
Well, I like to know it. Yeah, it's not the same, no, but it's good.
When the internet first arrived, I was in charge of the website, and it was fascinating. I was doing a weekend.
And when
program.
Did the internet first arrive, it was, would you say?
Well, it was pretty early on, but it was, I mean, I was creating it in Flash technology, if anyone remembers that, and everything had to sparkle and move. And Stuart Watson was a program man, you know, the CEO or whatever, and... We just experimented a lot, but I was doing a weekend show, and we put a camera in the studio, and it took one picture, one frame every minute. So it was dial-up speeds, I suppose. It's come a long way since then, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And when I went around the world on that boat race, it was sponsored by BT, so we had the best technology. But getting the audio back, well, we did that on a live normal link, but to send the pictures back took hours.
And it's hard, it really is hard to imagine that now when, you know, if I took out my phone probably has the capacity to play every record that you would need to play for a week.
Yeah.
It has, you know, that's where all the recordings are done. I've got a microphone that I can plug into it, but it doesn't need a microphone. Ideally, you use a microphone. And it records all the interviews that I need to record. We could have videos, we could have, you name it. And it's all in one tiny device compared with the huge devices that you used to have to carry around.
Well, we had a
set of batteries for when the battery ran out. And
we had these ewers, and they were portable ewers. So like small reels of tape, something you see on the Mission Impossible shows in those sort of times. And we had a load of them, but the batteries were always running out because they were rechargeables. And the amount, you know, going out and about, that was your only way of doing an interview. And quite often we had to use them in the building, because the building, it wasn't soundproof. I mean, the studios, you could hear next door. And when Mike Reynolds was making adverts in here, he had it loud. I mean, we were battling each other. No money in those days was ever seemed to be spent on the front end. It was really quite strange. You know, you think the studio should be the first place to be looked after, and the latest equipment. We didn't really get that at the time. And then we got one change of desk, and I don't think they asked anybody what they wanted. It was the most weirdest desk. We went backwards in time, and then
the desk for the uninitiated listener is much more than just a board with four legs. It's
it's the control panel.
Yeah,
and everything relies on that. But I mean, we just had a switch on and off for the microphone, which you wouldn't have these days. So. Especially Susie, we would halfway through a breathe, you go, she's clicking the button down. But yeah, so what was I? Yeah, back to what I was doing. So did the evening show for a long time. Stulo was doing the main thing, but then he was also doing the Lido and Summerland, which in things, and we'd go there live every Friday and Saturday nights. Crazy.
Oh, so those were broadcast live then?
Yeah.
Gosh.
He double earned, you know, he was earning from them. Trust has Forte down at Summerland, the cave. And someone had to sit up here. And all we had was like a field telephone. You push a button, it made a ringing noise. He couldn't hear anything down there. And we just had to dip in out to take the commercial breaks because someone had to sit up here. And quite often it was me. So, yeah, I kind of filled in. But I think then I was just thinking, I did the Top 40 show on a Friday. Somehow it changed. And we had this week where we were relying on the records. I had to go down to Woolies numerous times and borrow records because they hadn't arrived or they'd gone missing. And one week, the number one, we had not got it. So luckily I rang my friend at Downtown Radio in Northern Ireland, John Rossborough, and I got him to play the record so we could tape it. Because you couldn't have the chart show without the number one record,
it
could you
do,
really?
Would it?
Yeah. I tell you what, you lived with a wing and a prayer in those days. And the records would be in the studio, and then sometimes they would just disappear, and you go, oh, we've lost the record.
Yeah.
But yeah, chart shows. And then Saturday morning, we did Tony Miles did the breakfast show, and I did a mid-morning show. I think that's where the chart show moved to. But we had an hour overlap, and we had a sort of kids' hour. When the TV on Saturdays was doing their thing, and we had some fun there, you know, kids ringing up with jokes, and there was no delay. Some of them were a bit
right,
yeah,
inappropriate.
Well, no, they were just like, you just go thank you and move on quickly. No one taped it, so you know it's gone out. But yeah, that that was good time. I forgot about Tony Miles. Yeah, I don't know if he's around these days.
Who's that?
Tony Miles.
Tony Miles. Sorry, I thought you said 20 Miles.
No,
right.
Tony Miles.
Oh, gosh.
A lot of them have gone on to other things or aren't with us. I don't know, really.
Yeah.
But it was good times.
And important, you know, having a radio station that is there to be an essential part of the community.
I think that is what I'm saying, really, isn't it? Things have changed so much in all manners of things. And now, I mean, who'd have thought there'd be three radio stations on the Isle of Man, or maybe four if you count the AM thing.
And of course, where's the community is the other thing. I mean, yes, there is a strong community out there, but as we sort of alluded to already in the programme, people under 30, their community is online now. It's not. Even to the extent of not going out to physical places, it's, to me, a very strange and alien world.
Yeah, but you've got youngsters you're talking about, you know, that do that. Same with me. I mean, 21-year-olds, don't you know what the radio means? That's scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I don't think you can find them. I don't think they are accessible. Everyone chases this audience, which is really not going to go to the traditional... linear method of listening to music when they can get it on their things.
Well, I will struggle. This program being an example to edit it down to 90 seconds from the original 50 minutes. And if it's longer than 90 seconds, it's probably not worth watching on social media, which is quite bizarre, really.
I've had to learn to do that with my long format interviews, you know, on Isle of Man TV. Just, you've got to make things TikTok. Just different world, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you know, here we are, we're still going, and I'm so grateful that I lived through that sort of time. I mean, it was radio when you were on the frontier radio. And I'd say in the UK there's only 19 stations, so we were
so why big. Does it not feel quite so revolutionary now in terms of the new media that's available? Because it should be, shouldn't it? It should feel revolutionary because there are so many platforms available for people to broadcast on. There's so many opportunities there for people. It's remarkably cheap compared with the machines and devices that you used to have to have. Why is that revolutionary spirit not about, would you say?
I mean, you've got to make a product that stands out, I would say. And, you know, my views are very clear about, I'd have more speech on the station thing to stand out from the rest of the crowd. But there's a market for speech. I mean, look, who'd have thought that LBC and Times Radio would find such a market? Yeah. And I didn't, as a kid, like talk radio at all. I mean, I was music. And, you know, when I was younger, one day Stuart Watson says, I'm going on to Mandate with Charles Gard and David Collister. I'm like 20 or something. I have no interest in any of this. And I was put on this against my will, and I was useless. I didn't realise how dyslexic I really was. I couldn't read scripts. I didn't know the MHKs. Anyway, it only didn't last too long.
And in that regard, you're probably ideal for this, that job, because one of the biggest challenges I think we have is making politics real for younger generations, because it's so important. And you know, you kind of look at the deal that the younger generations have compared with our generation, and even the generation that's following us, generally things have been better of each generation, you know, that better than the parents' generation, until we get to the kind of the 20, 30, 40 year olds whose expectations are going to be worse than their parents. And that's quite a change. And that's the sort of thing that I would have thought would lead to some kind of revolutionary spirit amongst younger people, that, you know, that they would be looking for something that speaks to them.
Well, you could go downtown with pictures of MHKs and you know, depending on the age range, you probably get a very low response rate from the younger generation on who's running the place, who's in charge, who are their local MHKs are. I mean, that's just the way of the world, isn't it? And not just the Isle of Man, but trying to connect with them. Well, you know, there are ways. You need to put more of them on air, I think.
Yeah.
And not just the thing at the schools on Man Line, those sort of things. I would, you know, if you want me to do some work, let me know. It needs production. Everything needs production. And thoughts and new ideas. I think that's probably what needs to be done. Try and find those people.
And of course, when I was saying, where's the revolutionary spirit? The revolutionary spirit is probably there on a whole load of platforms, social media platforms that I just don't engage with, because I'm of a different era. Yeah, I mean, there are people we know. I mean, young Percy Hampton, for example, with his What's the Skeet,
yes,
which is has got a cult following now.
Yeah.
Cracking program. People are engaging with this in different ways.
Yeah, and you've got the guy Frank. He seems to be at everything that's happening. Brad Pitt gets on a plane.
Yeah.
He was the only media there. How did he get there? Good on him. You know, he's using his contacts, I'm guessing. But when we did the news, when I was working radio, the only competition was the papers, and they didn't get on with us really at all. But you know, when I first started into the radio here, the news on Manx Radio was like quarter past the hour in the morning. It was taped by Terry Kringle, Alan Bell, Colin as well was there. But it went out at quarter past the hour. Their thinking was people switched over on the hour to hear the BBC news and might come back to Manx Radio to hear the local news.
Right, yeah.
But that tape might run for hours now. That was, you know, the same news. But it was very much heavier, though, I'd say, on speech content than it is today. But you'd have a lot of inserts, as we call them, you know, people doing reports and that sort of thing.
And is it a change in people's requirements, or, you know, the people have just become more interested in, I don't know, different things? Or is it just that radio stations, newspapers have become interested in what they think the advertisers want?
You're pushing my buttons here, Phil. Well, you know what I'm going to say, and I'm trying to be as polite to the management here as I can, because you know, I don't want you editing the end of the
song. Well, ultimately, that's what pays the bills, isn't it?
And I've said that, and then had that huge Barney with Charles Gard in my interview, because you know he said you're the only one that doesn't agree with what we're doing. It's rubbish. My points were, you can't chase advertising and do a good community service, in my view, because the two of them. And hence, that's what the subvention money is for.
Yeah.
We're going around, you know, either play music or do the speech, but it's hard when you're got to produce an audience on, and be up on your numbers and, you know, to keep everyone happy. How do you do that? And I think it's an impossible task. I would come out of the Ray Jar thing completely. And that, then, you know, the advertisers will, may or may not decide they want, they like the new product.
And again, Ray Jar is a way of assessing who's listening to
and that's,
to
I think, the problems. There's too much pressure on how to deliver that audience and not be one thing or the other. And that's, you've got to, that's the job, though, is to find that.
But is that a symptom just of broadcasting, or is it also a symptom? And this is a much deeper and broader question that I should, I will probably be talking to Alistair Ramsay about in the next few weeks as we go into the election period. You know, is this a symptom of the whole way in which government has gone? You know, government is so obsessed now with having investigations and reports and understanding every single possible point of view that they couldn't see a really good idea if they fell over and broke their nose on it, you know.
You know, 10 years ago this very week, you, I was interviewing you about a certain building in Liverpool. You know.
I do.
But, I mean, on a slightly widening, what you, widening out what you're saying there is that I now have a problem, and I've said it many times before, that the government make their own PR to huge extents. When we would come in and talk to you as the media, that's now sort of given way to let's do our own.
Yeah,
and that is something.
That's something that the public should be nervous about, because
It should be out.
It's not challenged.
It's
basically
North Korean, and that's honestly because I've said it before. When they opened that fantastic tin shed in Liverpool, the media, as far as I understand, didn't get an invite, but they sent their own video people from, you know, working for government, and they made their own video. That should never have been done. They should have, for better or worse, let the media see it and report on it.
Absolutely.
But this is now happening more
again,
and more.
I mean, there was another good example of that. A whole load of politicians and civil servants went down to Westminster to celebrate Tynwald Day on the 4th of July down in the English Parliament.
What was that all about?
But there was no media invited. You know, you find out about it afterwards. And,
so Liverpool people came over the other week. They had a big up at the Comus. And I know there was no media there either. They just wrote it up, and the media seemed to consume it. And no one's questioning it.
There have been, and if anyone from Isle of Man's media team, Isle of Man government's media team is listening, I must have had a dozen press releases in the last week where I have thought, that would have been really good to cover if it hadn't have been a press release telling me about something that happened a week ago. You know, and we're not able to be there, so we're not able to cover
it. It's North Korean. Yeah, or Russian, whatever you want to call it.
I don't know whether it's necessarily North Korean.
No, the corn crop is up, and no one's there to tell you otherwise, because you're working off a press release which says that thing. You're not challenging these people.
I'm going to be carefully not describe it as North Korean, but it is a very controlled media or controlled way of getting your messages.
Should
over.
Never been allowed to happen. It's happened, and now I don't think you'll be able to push things back. I think.
But who's questioning it?
No, they're not.
And that's the other element to this. And again, as you'll know, if you are too hard on the politicians that come on your programmes, they don't come on your programmes. They just say, well, I'm not going to do it then. And that's a concern, I would say. Yeah, it should be a concern for people listening, because how are you going to get your news in the future if politicians genuinely think that they don't need to engage with the media, that they can do it through their own platforms?
Well, if the COVID thing happened again, now, that was a defining moment when the press had their moment each day. I don't think they would do it that next time. Mm. You know, I think they would just go, this is what we're saying, and that's it. Thank you for today, and we'll come back tomorrow.
Yeah,
they don't want to have those questions asked sometimes.
And I can understand, having been a politician, I can understand why there are certain questions perhaps you wouldn't want to be asked by the media, but your role, you know, and I think any wannabe MHKs listening to this need to realise this, their role very much is to communicate government's ideas with the public, and they can't do that by just telling the public their side of things. They have to be questioned by people who are paid to have the integrity to ask all the sorts of questions that need to be asked.
Yeah, but you know, without bigging up too much, you were very accessible. I mean, we had that great moment down at the sea terminal.
Which is probably why I'm sitting this side of the microphone now.
There was a man having a one-man demonstration because his knife had been taken off him or something. Mm. And he was, you know, and I covered it. And then I was told by the bobbies down there, the harbour ward, you can't film on our premises. And I said, excuse me, I just rang you. I said, da-da-da. And he said, of course you can. And I said, will you be available? He said, yeah, come upstairs and see me. Now, that is how it has to be, in my view, done. Because you cut the story dead in its tracks, but some people don't want to talk about anything, and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah, you know, we're living in a windmill situation at the minute, and you know, I'm shortly going to be talking to Orsted, but I've got to go through the hoops of talking to their PR company first or something in the UK, do a Zoom call just before I do the real interview.
And to be fair, from my perspective anyway, Orsted have always made themselves available. Not always immediately, but you know, whenever I've asked to do interviews with them, I've been able to do interviews with them. And equally, those who disagree with Orsted's position, I've given them opportunities as well. And you know, I'm happy to cover as much as I can. What I'd love to have is them both on the same programme, so that we could have some level of debate between them, which I think would be very interesting for people. But maybe that's a step too far, bearing in mind how emotive the issue is. Well, maybe that's what I need to do.
Sometimes it's just a question of putting it there. Then it's up to them to decide if they're not going to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that would be very interesting.
Yeah, and I suppose that at this stage, whilst that Orsted and those opposing the development are developing their plans and, you know, feeding into the inquiry, perhaps they need to get through that process before a head-to-head debate happens. And
well, we've gone off subject completely, but
but
the thing is, it's interesting, this whole thing about the windmills is that it wasn't a big issue maybe even 6 months ago, and then suddenly suddenly it's going to happen. And, you know, we've got people who are now calling it out. But maybe because since Drill Baby Drill was used, I think suddenly the world changed on that day. Yeah. Suddenly people are thinking twice about the renewables. I've got friends on both sides of this camp. So, you know, I love having solar panels on roofs and things. I think it's great. But I saw those windmills out at in Laxey looking over there. Mm. And it's a clear day. I thought, my goodness, they're quite noticeable, and they're the ones in the UK.
They're some distance
area
away. Yeah,
I
had the interesting example, for me anyway, the challenging experience of covering the previous public session for the inquiry, where those protesting against the proposal were speaking to the panel of experts. And my words were being used, and basically the words were, we're making this as easy as possible. The system is going to be as easy as possible for developers to use, or words to that effect. And one of the protesters came up to me afterwards and challenged me. What did you mean? And I guess what I meant was that we wanted it to be as easy as possible for people to be able to go through the process. What I didn't expect, I mean, trying to think back 10 years now, more than 10 years, what I didn't expect is that there would be no further conversation from what we had been discussing 10 years ago to the development being announced.
Yeah.
And that's, well, I mean, you alluded to Liverpool there. Similar sort of thing happens there. You know, there was a clear understanding about all the problems that could be faced when we set off with that project. When those problems became evident partway into the project, there was an opportunity for someone in government to get up and say, actually, you know how Phil Gorn said it was going to be this, we've now discovered a whole load of other things, which is why it's now going to be something else. And those conversations were never had.
But we still don't know how much money it costs.
Well, no.
And I don't think we're ever going to find out, do you? because there'll always be some of the money that has to be, we can't come up with this yet because we haven't had the final bill there or some more work. Transparency of government, there. We're completely on the subject.
Well, yes, yeah. Well, it is, isn't it? And a whole load of things could and should have been done, and certainly they were suggested very strongly that they needed to be done, which don't appear to have been done in terms of the whole way in which that project was handled. And there was a very good report, I think, by the Environment and Infrastructure Committee of Tynwald, which explains at least some of where things went wrong.
Do you think you'll get a plaque on the building eventually, Phil?
Would
you want a plaque on the building?
There's only one building that has my name on it, and that was the Tais Llewellyn out at St John's there. The what was the DEFA headquarters is now DEFA and DOE headquarters. That's my only claim to fame, and I'm quite proud of that building.
It's all right, isn't it? Yeah, I do like that one.
But anyway, the future. where does the future of broadcasting? Well, what's the future of broadcasting, Luke? Would you say?
Jeez,
you know, you've had your 50 years.
I thought we were dealing with the past, not the future.
Yeah.
The future. Well, clearly.
And does government have a role in that?
Okay. Why? And this is one of my big, you know, things I've gone back. Why has the Isle of Man not got a television station? I mean, Jersey and Guernsey share BBC two radio stations and a television news output, albeit 10 minutes a night or whatever, only started in about 2000, whereas ITV down there started about 65 or something. Mm. So that's, I've got my fingers on that because, you know, we're coming up to election time now and the BBC should be doing quite a lot of its own reporting. The problem is, and I work for the BBC here, I know how it was all working then, is that the BBC pay money to Manx Radio to have a room here, pay half their internet and pay for reception and all that sort of thing. And it's just not right. In my view, I would separate them off completely. And you know, BBC material is used for courts. It shouldn't. There's enough people here to cover court cases in its own right and give more polarity to what's going on. So why hasn't the Isle of Man never had a TV station? It's got very close. There was all sorts of talk of it happening, but we have tons of radio, but that's now.
And is it because there are too many competitors in the whole media market that we've got? I mean, I don't know. Is that the reason that there isn't enough funding around
TV's moving on completely. So I was going to say now it's too late for just terrestrial. And an opt-out of BBC is going to be impossible because its transmissions over here is huge. But it could be done, but the boat has sailed. What the BBC now over here should be doing is basically what I was doing at MTTV, having a place with studios, doing interviews, getting out obviously with cameras and recording the Tynwalds and debates and things like that, and putting a lot more money into the Isle of Man. I know you were on the committee. They agreed to cover the costs of Manx programmes on Manx Radio.
Yeah,
is that still going on?
Yes, yeah. And of course the BBC provides Celtic language content in Irish, Welsh and Scottish Gaelic as well to a far greater extent than
you
are
the Manx and you got that. You're heading the committee. They couldn't be more happy to settle with you because they got off cheaply basically. They knew they were getting off cheaply because no one can find out how much they're spending on the Isle of Man, Channel Islands output. Hmm. But two radio stations and a TV station out of the licence fee, and what do we get?
Yeah.
And I've worked here at BBC and it's got better. I mean, there's more people here now, but it's not enough.
Hmm.
And it's too easy to piggyback on Manx Radio to give them copy and use their material and, you know, they'll cover the courts. No.
It's part of the... Well, part of the problem must be that society generally doesn't seem to understand or get the need for proper scrutiny with properly funded media outlets. Do you think that's an issue, or is that just a fanciful notion on my part?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I say the licence fee covers the BBC, right? I mean, I know Josh from ITV, and I've done that job as well
with
Granada. He's a one-man band, basically.
Mm. And doing a cracking job.
Yeah, but, you know, it's 1% of their audience. When we were at Border TV, it was like 18% or something like that. So, but, you know, one guy can cover almost what the BBC isn't doing here. I mean, I'm going to get flack for that. But the fact is, I know the BBC would move if they were challenged. What we don't have over here is enough oomph to challenge the BBC to do more. Your committee was probably the last time they were actually hauled in front of anyone. And as soon as you asked for anything, they capitulated because they knew they're getting away with murder on paying for a proper service. How many licence fees in the Isle of Man? And that money, this percentage of that that goes on local coverage, and we should be a region, not just a little ghetto-y thing. No one complains. Maybe it's too late for anything. Maybe we'll all just get it off the internet from anybody, and that's a dangerous thing, isn't it?
And then we move back. Let's go back to the very start of this story with Charlie Carouche and others fighting very hard the British establishment to ensure that Manx Radio could exist. Do you think our current politicians have either the fight in them or even the understanding to be able to take on battles like that?
What battle were you thinking of?
Well, the one you've just been describing, to get more funding.
No, because there's no one got media in their title. I think that's I've kind of argued that for a long time. If there was a minister that had that responsibility, I mean, at one stage, the Communications Commission had a minister or an MHK as
their
head.
Home Affairs.
But that's gone,
minister.
Right? It's Cura now. It's just run by its own
and
people.
Going back to your North Korea introduction earlier, yeah. I think it was only North Korea and one other rather dodgy sounding country and the Isle of Man that had a minister as head of the Communications Authority. So I think that was the reason why that went.
Sorry, yeah, but you have ministers in the UK, you know, media is their title, they are, and that's their job.
Yeah.
But there's no one, I don't know where it sits. It sits in Home Affairs, isn't it?
I mean, I'm partially trying to push you into the direction of an answer here.
You are.
But
no comment.
To me then, that is the reason, that's part of the problem.
Oh, let me ask that.
Because we have no central policy function that is actually considering what the future of media in the Isle of Man should look like.
Well, the media on the Isle of Man should look more like you, and there should be more of you.
I suppose the other thing about working in the media, which may or may not come as a surprise to the public, is you can get far better paid jobs working in government than you'll ever get being a journalist in any of the news outlets in the island.
Yeah, and you know, there's no churn rate here, you know, in the Isle of Man particularly, is there? People, in the UK, you'd be moving stations and gathering better knowledge of how things work, and you pass that on. Here, I think it's very isolated. I know at one stage the BBC gave training in the newsroom here, but was it appreciated by everyone? I know it wasn't for some, but that's where it was. I mean, back to what I started. I didn't like doing any of the stuff like that. I was just a DJ, and then doing Swap Shop was my zenith, I think, of my moment when we moved all the calls on air. That was just, and no delays and things like, oh gosh, looking quite weird. But anyway, then it's only later life I've got into the doing interviews with politicians, and I really enjoy it. I enjoy it because I do think I ask some of the better questions sometimes, and there's nothing worse when you hear someone just roll over and have their tummy tickled.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that you just know that that's not an interview.
Absolutely. I'm going to, because we are just about out of time, I am going to ask if you can remember what was the most bizarre thing on Swap Shop.
Well, the one I got caught for, and I was young and I wasn't really thinking about it, was a left-handed screwdriver for a right-handed screwdriver. Those classic ones, you know, that... But, I mean, I say, really, we got away with murder, because, I mean, I had to key the live call into my headphones, and then don't forget those do 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 do. So you put that 10p in. And then you took a chance on what was going to come out, but it moved it on, because I mean, writing down every bloomin' swap, and then think of that now. People wouldn't understand a swap shop.
I mean, and I guess the equivalent to that is trying to present the Man in Line, which I seem to be dropped off the reserve list for that lately. But yes, you have to not only be taking calls, making the programme reasonably entertaining, and trying to read out the texts. And
I did
a couple
of mail
times when those texts have got the better of me.
Me too. I mean, I tried my life. I thought I could do it. And you're dependent on callers, aren't you?
Well, sadly, that's us.
Well, we never really
will
do
you
much,
come
we?
Back in another 50 years' time? And
I'll come back at 60. How's that, if I live that long? But truly, Phil, leave this in. Please leave this in. You're doing a good job, you know, and we need to hear more, not just you, but more people who are prepared to stick their neck out and challenge people. I think that's really, really important. And that will get more people listening.
That was Manx broadcaster Paul Moulton. So what do you think? How will broadcasting change in the next 50 years? Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gawne. Go to Myosin Geisha Crum. Thanks for listening.